Hi, y'all. My name is Anita Johnson, and my alias is Sam. Thank you. And I am a grateful member of the Big Book Al-Anon Family Group in Dallas, Texas. And, oh, my God, they can hear me now.
Yeah.
And I have no earthly idea of what I'm going to say, so y'all better say a prayer for me here. Okay. They didn't tell me. I usually write my name down so I can remember it, and that's not my name. But like I say, I'm a grateful member of the Al-Anon Family Group, and I want to thank the committee for inviting me. I haven't decided yet why they invited me, but that's okay. It's my turn. And I've got to tell you that Ortha and Gary have been absolute wonderful hostess and host. And you other speakers, I got the good ones. And, they have been absolutely wonderful to us and feeding us. And Ortha's been giving me little presents and encouragements because she knew I was shaking like this. You know, I'm kind of like the duck that I look calm up here. Those feet are going 90 miles an hour down below. Let me tell you why I think I'm in Al-Anon. I know there's not, you're not supposed to give opinions from this podium, but I have a point of view. And this is the reason that I think that I'm in Al-Anon, is because I have a home group. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I sponsor people that sponsor people. I've taken the 12 steps, and I've taken the traditions, and we use them in our home. So, and I do my service work in my home group and wherever else they invite us. We're having a conference right now in Dallas called the North Texas Roundup. And part of that conference is they certify you to go in the jails. And I was intending to do that so that I could go in the jails, because I got to tell you that I couldn't go in last Christmas with my husband and talk, because I wasn't certified and they didn't let me in. So I thought, I'll show them, I'll just get certified. So, but that's all right, I can get certified later, and there's many places in order to do that. Like I say, I have no earthly idea of what I'm going to say here. God's going to shake it out of me in a minute. I understand that. I had told Lorcina earlier, I was certainly glad it wasn't a competition, because I hate losing. You know, we're very good competitors. And I've got to tell you, I absolutely love AA and the members in AA, because it's been AA people that have gotten me here, that have kept me here, and they weren't necessarily Larry either. That I was born in a small town that, a long time ago, far, far away, a long time ago. And I've got to tell you this, because I have found cousins that, you know, cousins now get away from you and this sort of thing. And when I tell people where I'm from and where I was born and this sort of thing, I've had cousins afterwards pop up that I had lost track of and, you know, just barely remembered who they were. I know I was in Wichita Falls one time, and I told them where I was born and this sort of thing. And so after the meeting, he came by. This little guy came by, and he said, "Do you know?" And he started naming all these people that are my relatives. And finally I said, "Could you tell me your name, please?" And so he told me, and it was one of my cousins. And another time I was in Dallas and found another cousin. Now, these were all men. The women are probably Al-Anon somewhere, but they're hiding their head in the sand, I assure you, because I did that many years. Like I say, I was born in Cooper, Texas, and it's kind of a northeast Texas area place. And I guess when I was 9 months old, my father died. And my mother had to move to Dallas in order to get work and this sort of thing. And this was during World War I. Does that tell you how old I am? And and she came to Dallas, and she wanted desperately to bring me to Dallas with her to stay with some relatives so that she could see me when she was not working. Well, even at 9 months old, I must have been a little brat, because I wanted to stay with my grandmother and my grandfather, because my mother was the eldest of 8 children, and she was the only one left. My youngest uncle is only 4 years older than I am, and I wanted to stay with the kids. So I stayed with my grandparents, and I always perceived in my mind that I was really unloved, and this isn't true. This was just a perception. Al-Anons have the perceptions that are totally untrue also. They also have expectations that are totally unreal. And and I guess, like I say, my father died when I was 9 months old. When I was 18 months old, I was cross-eyed, and I had to have an operation and start wearing glasses. Now, this is another stigma in my mind, because kids can be so ugly, you know, telling you you're your 4 eyes and you know, you're not pretty and this sort of thing. And it affected me, because I'm a people pleaser, and I want you to like me. And so I was growing up with that without a father. When I was 4 years old, my mother remarried. And I've got to tell you, I can't say that he's an alcoholic or whatnot, but he certainly waddled and quacked. So, and we had many disagreements. I was telling you that I thought I was totally unloved. Well, I had relatives in Dallas when my mother was working down here that wanted to keep me or adopt me even. And it was like, no. And so when my mother married my stepfather, his brother and his wife wanted to adopt me, because they had 2 sons, and I would be the little girl, the little princess, right in between. And they said no. And my mother said no, that she loved me too much to let someone else have me. And, of course, I didn't see it that way. I was wondering what was going on. But we moved from, well, just before we moved, my mother got pregnant. Now, this is back in the days when you don't tell your kids you're pregnant or anything like that. It's like, surprise, one day you have a little brother or a little sister or something like that. Well, she is pregnant, and she had this baby prematurely. And so back in those days, you don't touch the little preemies. So I felt unloved again, because all the attention was on this baby and not on me. Now, I've got to also tell you that I think after the first step, all Al-Anons are just like AAs. I mean, we have to do the first step. We're obsessed with alcoholics, not alcohol, and control issues and this sort of thing. But our grandson later, this has been much later, his mother was telling him when she was pregnant, you're going to be a big brother, isn't that neat, you know, and she kept telling him that and building him up. And so he was thinking one day, and he said, hey, Mom, if you have a little girl, will I be a big sister? And I thought, I like the way this kid thinks. It made logic to me. But anyway, I had this little sister, and I could have nothing to do with her. We moved from Paris, Texas to Dallas, and that's where I went to school. And, you know, I've got to tell you, I always needed Al-Anon, because sometimes I became the caretaker when I didn't want to be. We were talking earlier about Lincoln, Nebraska. As I was growing up, I had this father that drank too much. And I had a dear girlfriend that as much time as possible I would go and spend with her, and she and her mother, and I thought that was okay. But I never wanted her to come to my house, because no telling what my alcoholic stepfather would do to embarrass me. Well, come to find out, her father was in prison, and I thought that was okay. And so I went on vacation with them 1 year, and they lived in Minnesota. Her grandparents lived in Minnesota, and we stopped in Lincoln, and surprise, surprise, I get to meet her father. Now, I don't know if he was a horse thief or whatever he was, you know, hot checks. I don't know why he was in prison, never cared. But this family is very important to me because later I went to live with them. I went through high school. This family had moved. He had gotten out of prison, and they had moved to a little town called Irving, Texas, which nowadays is just a suburb of Dallas. And so I went on through high school in Dallas and this sort of thing, and went to church. I was such a good girl. I went to church, you know, every time the doors were open, and was in the GAs and tried to get into the RAs, but they wouldn't let me because that was for boys. Like I say, I continued to go to church and this sort of thing. When I graduated from high school, I wanted to go to college. And I really couldn't afford it unless I worked and this sort of thing. So this girlfriend's father and mother invited me to come and live with them out in Irving and got me a job and a car, and I was able to live with them, go to school, and work. Now, Al-Anons are extremely obsessive, too. I just told you that we're not much different from AAs because we're weird. We really are. And so I got this job, and I was going to school, and all of a sudden, I'm a late bloomer. I discover boys. And so I was working, going to school, and trying to date, and this sort of thing. And it got entirely too much. There's not enough hours in the day to do all of this stuff, to work an 8-hour day, to take a full load in college and date. I mean, you're running out of time. So something had to go. So, you know, smart. They call it keen alcoholic thinking. I don't think so. This is Al-Anon thinking. I quit school so I could work and have money for clothes to go out on dates and this sort of thing. Well, then the dates kind of dried up there for a little while, and so I'm working along, and I decided I needed another job, so I applied to the telephone company. And back in those days, you went to work for the telephone company and worked for 40 years, retired, and died. But so I got on at the telephone company, and we've been talking about to work ethics this week where I work now. And I was working for White's Auto Store, and I'm the type of person, I was hired to take the money in and run the cash register and do a little bit of filing and this sort of thing. And I learned how to do that. I got bored. So I learned how to sell on the floor. I learned how to do all the books in the office, you know, and this sort of thing. And it's real easy to do when it's not your job, really. You know, you can learn to do all of this and do it when you want to. And so when I went to work for the telephone company, my boss out there, and by the way, he's the one that named me Sam. He started calling me Sam the office boy because I wore blue jeans all the time because we had rode horses and this sort of thing. And so, you know, I would get ready in case I got off from work halfway early to go and ride the horses. So I had blue jeans, and I wasn't real well endowed. And so he started calling me Sam the office boy, and it really stuck. Everybody calls me Sam now. They only call me Anita, you know, like the IRS and things like that. You know, our family members. Of course, my family members don't call me Anita. They call me Neely. They just run my middle name and my first name and my middle name together and all of this good kind of stuff. Now, I got to tell you, I was always needing Al-Anon, and I never heard of it. Now, I went to work for the phone company. This guy wanted to fire his, he told me if I wouldn't go, he would fire the office manager and give me a raise and let me stay there. Well, the office manager was my friend. And so I told him, no, I wouldn't do that. So he said, well, shortly after I left, she quit. I don't know why. So he called me, and so I was working for the phone company and then going on weekends to balance his books and so forth at White's Auto Store. Well, this got kind of boring and all. Nothing was going on in my life. So I started working for as a key punch operator at Zales at night during the week. And so, you know, that way I'm getting a full day. I work for the phone company. I go to work at Zales at night and weekends at White's Auto Store. And then I had a friend that worked for Montgomery Ward's in the catalog department. And it was, you know, coming time when they were really busy and they were shorthanded. So I volunteered, you know. It wasn't real hard for me to learn to say yes when I once came to Al-Anon, because I've been volunteering for everything all my life. And so now I have 4 jobs, you know, and I got to tell you, if I sold you anything at Montgomery Ward's that you didn't use, I was just working my mouth trying to get a sale, who knows. But, and then during this time, there was a girlfriend at the telephone company. She decided I really didn't have a life, and that she had a boyfriend, and that he could get me a blind date. So she set me up with a blind date, and this blind date started calling me about 2 weeks before. It was probably just right after New Year's in 66, and immediately we started lying to each other. Haven't laid eyes on each other, but we're lying to each other, you know, telling us all sorts of things. I've got to tell you, one of the things that this blind date told me was that he was a paratrooper and jumped out of planes and all of this kind of stuff. And actually, I'm really gullible. Maybe not as much as I used to be, but I'm really gullible. And I was telling him things like, I weighed this much then. I weighed about 98 then. And trying to scare him off, I think. Finally, we went out on this blind date. And, of course, y'all know where we went. We went straight to a club. I don't even think he ever fed me. You know, I mean, it was drinking all night. And we set up a date for the next day. And he was new to Texas. So, he could find my girlfriend's house. And y'all, she almost kept him. She fed him breakfast before she would tell him where I lived and this sort of thing. And I'm wondering, why isn't he calling or why isn't he here? Now, this started, like he said, it's not a courtship. It was kind of an arrangement, whatever. And on Sunday, that Sunday when he finally got there, I think we went to play some golf, we played some tennis, and we may have gone bowling. You know, we did everything because we're obsessive. You know, let's do everything before time runs out. And wore me out, actually, you know, doing all of these things in one day. But this started our relationship. And what would happen was, after a few days or something, now, he drives funny now, but he really drove funny in those days. And he would come over, and I would say, honey, I don't get to drive new cars all the time, because he was in the car business and had demos that you're not supposed to let anybody else drive. And I said, could I drive your car? And it's like, sure, why not? So our dates started consisting of, he would come over, hand me the keys, we would drive down to a little drive-in. I swear, I don't know if they had any food or not. And I would buy him drinks until I ran out of money or he passed out, whichever came first. And then I would drive back home, hand him the keys, and hope he would get home all right. Now, there was a few times that he was totally unable to get home. It must have been after payday or something. And he had to sleep on my couch. And that did not go over well with my mother and my stepfather. And my sister thought it was kind of funny, you know, actually. But it kept them up all night, because I guess they were afraid I was going to go in and talk to him, or he was going to wander someplace else. And one of the amends that I had to make to my stepfather was that I did come in really late one night, and he had gotten up. I don't know. He may have been waiting on me. I don't know. And he said, "Well, why didn't you invite him in for breakfast?" And I said, "Well, I didn't know you had it ready. I'll go get him." And, you know, just little picky things like this. My stepfather and I actually most of the time did not get along well. But I've got to tell you that later on, I was able to take care of him in his old age and this sort of thing after my mother died. That little sister I told you about was his actual daughter, and she was totally incapable of taking care of him, so somebody had to, and you know, I'm a control freak, so I was able to take care of him. But then after a while of this dating, Larry would go out and get drunk, and the first time he did this and got put in jail, he called me up and he said, "Hun, I'm in jail. Could you come and get me in the morning? And it may cost a little money, but would you come and get me?" And I thought, "Oh, he needs me." Now, I already knew all of his relatives and this sort of thing. He had absolutely no one in Texas except me, I thought. I get down to the jail the next morning, and I run into this girl that I had seen before, and I said, "What are you doing down here?" And she said, "Well, Larry called me to come." Really? Now, I found out much later that Larry had gotten out of jail and was standing back because he saw both of us standing there, and he wanted to see who won. I did. She left, and, you know, I got to pay the bill, and I got to drive him home, and all of this good kind of stuff. He did tell y'all that we fell into sick, didn't he? This started, you know, this happened all the time. I mean, one time he was in jail, and I had to go and get his brother. His brother wasn't in jail. I had to go and get his brother. He came to visit him and take him home and this sort of thing. And, you know, this continued to happen all the time. And he told you about the lawyer dying and this sort of thing. The lawyer used to not go unless Sam came to pick him up and took him down to the jail and then brought him home. And usually I would pay the bill because, you know, drinking is expensive. And more so nowadays. I don't know how people do it nowadays. But back in those days, you know, I thought it was expensive. And I certainly tried to keep up with him, but I never could. Never could. We have a few of the guys at the Big Book group sometimes will tell me, "If you just had another beer, you might could come into our room." And said, "No, I've already tried that. It doesn't work." But we kept going to jail. And now, this rocked along for a while, and I've got to tell you about another deal that he usually did. Now, he always let me drive. After that very first time, he always let me drive because I'm a control freak. He lets me drive today, too. And if he happens to be driving, you can better bet that I will have his car keys in my purse just in case that I need to take over. And but we would go out on a date, which usually consisted of me driving him around and him drinking. And sometimes he was in the back seat and sometimes he was in the front seat. But it was like, "Let's go to Oklahoma and get married." "Nah, well, it's too soon," and, you know, this sort of thing. "Probably not." Yeah, "let's go to Oklahoma and get married." And so I would start down 75 to go to Oklahoma, and he would pass out, and I'd turn around and go home. Y'all, this happened not once, not twice, not three times. This happened a bunch of times. So finally, I had gone to my pastor, because I told you I'd gone to church a bunch up until I got grown. And and talk to him. And since Larry had been married before, he wanted to talk to both of us, not just one of us. And so we had set this deal up that we would meet in about 2 weeks. And so I guess this was May the 26th. He was working, and he went out. And what happened was that, I'm telling you this because Al-Anons can lie probably better than AAs and get away with it. He went out to drink, and he was coming home. I was waiting at his apartment because we had a date. It's getting pretty late, and this is kind of stupid. This is getting to be midnight or so, or quite late, or 11. I don't know what it was. And while he was coming up in Dallas, he went to stop at a red light. Well, he stopped, but there was a car in front of him, so he hit it. And he said, whoops, and he backs up, and he hits another car. And so they all pull into the service station. The other two people call the police, and Larry calls Sam. And I go running because he needs me. I get down there, and you ladies know, I don't care if you're AA or Al-Anon, y'all know that if you're talking to a policeman and you know another policeman, and I happen to have two cousins on the police department, and it's like, do you know? And if that doesn't work, then there's always the tears. And so I start crying and saying, you know that this was his bachelor party and that we're getting married. And, you know, he must have been tired of me or something, or believed me or something. And he said, okay, I will let you take him home, but I'm going to keep the car. I said, okay. So I go over, and Larry's already in the back of the car, you know, with its handcuffs behind him and this sort of thing. And he starts getting out, and I say, honey, this nice man's going to let me take you home, but he's going to impound your car. And it's like, oh, my dog won't hunt. And so they throw him back in the car, and he goes to jail. And so it was the next day that I got him out, and he asked me this question about, you know, what we should do. And I told him that we should get married because I firmly believed that a good woman is all he needed to take care of his alcoholism, or I didn't even call it that, his drinking problem. And I've got to tell you, even after we got married, my mantra was, if only he would stop drinking, it would be okay. I got to tell you, folks, sobriety, if that's the only thing you do, if it's the only thing you do, both in for AA and for Al-Anon, that's not enough. And I've always got to remember that in Al-Anon, it's is alcoholism, not wasm. And, you know, I still have isms also. Like I say, we got him out of jail, and he's tried to make amends, y'all. Look at this. He keeps saying that amends can be completed, and with this one, I kind of, maybe not. He sponsors a jeweler, too, so we kind of get in cahoots occasionally. But we got married, and by this used car salesman in Oklahoma, we almost got thrown in jail again because on the way back, this friends of ours and all, we stopped in Sherman, and actually they kicked us out of this club because they thought that since the guys had on suits that they were the liquor control board. And so they kind of kicked us out because they didn't like us up in Sherman. And the next day, I decided that we would move from his apartment because there were too many keys out that weren't for me. So we always do things in excess. And that one day, we called his boss and told him that we were moving and this sort of thing, and nobody was thinking it was going to work, and we didn't either. But we moved out of his apartment, we moved out of my apartment, into our apartment. Now, this started a trend with us. You know, every time rent came due, we moved. We got very proficient at it. And like I say, our marriage did not get better, did not help his alcoholism. We had a little girl in 1970, and she's the light of my life. And I have two other stepchildren now, and they all belong to Larry. But and I've got to tell you, we've got the smartest grandkids of anybody in the whole wide world. We really do. They're all talented, and they're all smart, and they all show potential. That really worries me. Because most of the time, people that have potential don't live up to them. Like I say, our marriage did not get better, and I'm still thinking, if only he would quit drinking, everything would be okay. Everything would be okay. It's not. And he told you what happened. Now, that night on September the 17th, the miracle started happening, because when he told me to call, now, first of all, earlier than that, when he came in, never before had I refused to give him anything he wanted. But that night he came in, and I don't know what happened. He asked for money, and I said, no. And, you know, he tried everything in the world, from being real lovey-dovey, this sort of thing, and it was like, get away from me, to being mean and hateful and throwing things, and that's how he ended up in the middle of the floor, y'all. He was throwing things and he fell down. But, and of course the TV is on, because in a drunk's house or a drunk's family, the TV is always on for noise. And the miracle started happening the instant he said to call this number on this screen. And the miracle is, the phone was in another room. I cannot remember numbers to this day, phone numbers, nothing. And he said, go call these people. And I was able to go into the other room and call that number. And go and, you know, get some help. And the man told me, the man that I talked to, it was a man named Tony Sherman in AA. And he was very, very helpful to me. And so I went and got him booze and put him to bed. Now, I needed to go to work the next day, so I had to call in. But I got up like a good little Al-Anon. And packed his bag and this sort of thing and woke him up. I said, honey, it's time to go to treatment. He said, let's think about this. Well, I don't know what happened. I probably gave him the only threat that I've ever given him. And it's like, if you don't get up right now and go to treatment with me, I will have the police out here before noon, and I hope they bury you way under the jail. And I must have been sincere, because he got up and went to treatment. Now, he tried to escape. Once we got there, we had a suitcase in the back of the car, and we were in the lobby because we didn't know what to do. And so we were talking to Tony, and Larry said, give me the keys. I'm going to go and get my suitcase out of the trunk. And I'm looking at him, and finally Tony says, let me have the keys. And he goes and gets the suitcase out of the trunk and brings me back the keys. And it's amazing. This halfway house was, what, about two blocks from our house, and we never knew it was there, called Center Hospital. Now, at this point in time, I did not know anything about Al-Anon or AA, nothing. Now, I had heard the words alcoholics because some of Larry's family called him that, but I didn't know what it meant. I really didn't, and I certainly didn't know what Al-Anon meant. Tony put him into this place, and one of the conditions was that you cannot see anybody or talk to your family for 10 days. I got to tell you, that was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. You know, I got some rest. I've got to tell you also that a telephone call from a jail has a different ring than just, you know, Ortha calling me. I know this is true because we get calls now. We're in a position where some of the guys call from jail to talk to Larry, and it totally does have a different ring. I am not crazy. It really does, and I won't answer it. because I know they're always calling for him nowadays, and it's not him. But I used to answer that, but I would always know, you know, he didn't ever have to say, I never had to say, where are you? Because I could always know. Now, we got into the program, and let me tell you about Tony. He said, now what he said was, there is a program for you, and they had just started at this hospital a meeting, or they were trying to start this meeting at this hospital, and a little lady named Babs B was speaking that night, and what he said was, there is a meeting for you that you need to go to. What I heard was, there's a meeting that you need to go to keep him sober. And I thought, something else to do. And so I started going to Al-Anon, and I thought, okay. You know, and I heard Babs talk, and she had about 8 kids, and I thought it was hysterical. 8 kids and a drunk husband, and I'm wondering, you know, this woman is a miracle worker. But we started going to, after I could go back in and see Larry and take our daughter to see him, we started going to the suburban group. And I was trying to start, this is a blind leading the blind, I don't know what I'm doing, trying to start an Al-Anon group here at the hospital. And I would go over to suburban on Monday night, and whatever they said, I would bring back on Wednesday nights for our little Al-Anon group that didn't know anything anyway, so hopefully I didn't hurt anybody. My first sponsor was over at that group, and she was a love, and she helped me, you know, get the you know, first things first and all of those little things. And I've only had 3 sponsors. Now, the first one, I let her go. I didn't really let her go. I kind of replaced her because she could no longer come to meetings because her husband had died and her son was quite ill and she couldn't go to meetings. So I kind of added Gracie to it, and I kept Gracie for, almost 30 years, I assume, until she died. And I've got to tell you, someone asked Gracie, my sponsor, one time, are we ever fully recovered? And she said, oh, yes, honey, we're fully recovered when we're covered. And I thought, you're right, because this is a journey. This Al-Anon program is a journey. Many good things have happened to us. Like I said, I told you a while ago, the miracles started happening right away. At about 2 years, now, when I started, they did not force, somebody had said it earlier, they did not get you to start doing the steps or anything like that right away. And for about 2 years, I was riding on just people like me. They would let me come to meetings. They would even invite me to their house. Birthday parties or something at the group, and I thought this was wonderful. And they would even let our daughter go. She grew up actually in Al-Anon and AA. And I've got to tell you a story about her. She went to so many AA meetings. Y'all remember the old carpet sweepers? She was playing one day in the room, and she was by herself, and I happened to look in on her, and she was standing on the carpet sweeper with the handle right in front of her, and she said, my name is Lori, and I'm an alcoholic. And she's the only one in the room. And then she said, wait a minute, I don't drink, and got off and went about her business. So does that tell you how many meetings she went to? And it also tell you, little ears hear everything. During this point in time, after we'd gotten into the program, Larry had to go back to jail one last time, we hope. And I took him, and I had to go and pick him up. And so whenever I was picking him up, I had to go to this little intake thing and talk to this man. And so when I went up and asked for Larry, this little guard said, Mrs. Johnson, it's so good to see you again. Let me tell you about my open heart surgery. And, you know, how many people know the guards that well from just the sick people? That's what it is. And I was telling you a while ago that I was riding high just on friendship and that cloud nine or whatever. And we used to have people that you would invite from out of town. Now, they may come in on the bus, you know, like from Arkansas, or if they had a car, they might drive in. But what would happen is, like, if they came in on Friday, one group would feed them, meet them, and sleep them. And then another group would pick them up the next day and feed them, meet them, and sleep them. And we got this Henry on a Saturday night or something, and he was going home on Sunday. And I can remember now he was walking out to his car, and he was a wonderful AA guy. And I said, Henry, Larry's doing so well in AA now. Why do I have to go to Al-Anon? And he said, well, Sam, you know, if you have two jackasses pulling a cart and one of them sits down, that cart doesn't move worth a flip. And he said, but if they're both straightened up and their harnesses are really good on them, you know, they pull that cart just fine. So now what do you think you ought to do? That kept me in Al-Anon. I got to thinking, you know, if he's doing so good, I better figure out what in the world is going on here and maybe take some of these steps and see what is going on, because I don't want him to be like I'd heard about doctors that had this wife that put them through medical school and then trade them in for a younger model and this sort of thing. I thought, not going to happen to me. So I didn't want him to trade in me for a younger and better looking alcoholic with keen minds and beautiful, because there for a while I bought into that deal. They kept telling me that alcoholics had a keen mind and were so smart and so beautiful and this sort of thing that, you know, that it was just wonderful. And I kept thinking, I wonder what I am, chopped cheese, what, you know. And I bought into this, and I was absolutely horrified of AA women, because I just knew they were smarter and prettier and all of this kind of stuff. And the dumbest things get through to me. You know, we were at a birthday or an anniversary meeting, and a dear friend of ours, who is in AA, a woman, was standing there, and it was time to eat. And she was standing there, and she said, and she was not talking to anybody in particular. She was just mouthing, I wonder why the Al-Anons don't go and uncover that food. And for some reason, I spoke up and I said, why do Al-Anons have to do that? And she said, oh, you're right. And so she went and uncovered the food, and I got to eat first instead of her. But this broke my fear of AA women. I love them to death. I've gone to many conferences that were just, I was the only Al-Anon there, but they accepted me anyway. Like I say, I grew up, our dates used to be, we would go to meetings on Saturday night at the maybe the 8 o'clock and then at 10 o'clock, and then we might go to a movie or we might go to the midnight, you know, candlelight meeting or something. That was our dates. That was our courtship after we were married and after we got into AA and Al-Anon. And many miracles, like I say, have happened since then. In 1973, and I've got to tell y'all, I'm the follower. I only go out in front whenever I have to or something of the sort. But in 73, Larry was helping, being of service at the state convention in Texas. And I got to meet Lois Wilson. And I got to have coffee with her. Now, I thought she was a sweet little old lady and all. And it was much later that I realized, oh, my God, what a privilege this has been. You know, I was able to meet Marty Mann. And I've been able to meet many heroes and go to Bedford Hills and all of this. And like I say, I just tag along after Larry. I mean, he does the work and this sort of thing, and I tag along and enjoy all the benefits, in my opinion. But many other things have happened. At one point in time, we thought, okay, I'm going to Al-Anon, and he's going to AA, and we kind of kept them separate. You know, it's my program. You don't need to know anything about it. And we got to thinking about this one day. In our home, it's our program. We have as much Al-Anon stuff and AA stuff, and we're both free to do it. And, you know, our sponsors tell us to pray in the morning and at night and this sort of thing. And this was going on, but one of us was usually going into the bathroom or some other place. And all of a sudden, it was like, why are we doing this? This is our program. And so we had started praying together, kneeling by the bed and praying together. And I tell you what, it's real hard to fight if you're going to pray together, I assure you. And this has brought us together. Other miracles that have happened, it's been almost 4 years now since I'm cancer-free. And this was back in 07. It was very, very humbling. Whenever I found out I had breast cancer, I don't know, AA and Al-Anon have a network that's much faster than the telephone company or anything else. And all of a sudden I was getting cards and phone calls and prayers. I kid you not, from the East Coast to the West Coast and all in between. And I can remember one little lady that I don't know. Larry didn't know her. I got a card from her saying, you know, it's rainy here and cold, but I'm hoping that you're warm and snug and having a wonderful day. And signed her name. I do not know who this person is, but she didn't give me a return address either. So I could not, you know, thank her for that. It's very, very humbling, knowing that people are praying for you and wishing you well, you know, from the East Coast to the West Coast and all in between. Another miracle that has happened, I was telling you about Lori, the one that said that she was an alcoholic. She's an MRI tech in Spartanburg Regional in South Carolina. And one day they had to do some new protocols on their machines and this sort of thing to see if it was working right, to set up the right protocols. And everybody in that building, for some reason, could not get in the machine. You have to have a person in the MRI machine to set the protocols and so forth. Lori was the only one that could get in there. She had one that was pregnant and they didn't want to do that, and one that had to run it, and there was only two or three of them. So she crawled in there and put on her headset and this sort of thing, and they took the protocols, and she got out, and they were looking at it, and she said, what is this? So there is a spot on her pancreas. And, of course, the radiologist there, the doctor, said, go to your doctor right now and take these. And so she went to a doctor, and she had to have... Now, y'all know that if you see anything on your pancreas, it's you, and if you're feeling it, it's too late. So, but she wasn't feeling anything. She went to the doctor, and they were able to do an operation on her, and they took out her spleen and took out part of her pancreas and where this whatever was, growth was, and she's doing great. Now, is that not a miracle? You know, in 07, I told you I was wearing glasses. I no longer have to wear glasses except to read up close or anything because they did an operation on my eyes. God is good. And, you know, to me, these are big miracles. But we have many little miracles in our life. We just have to be grateful for them. Al-Anon has taught me to be grateful. And you show your gratitude by your attitude, usually. I know a lot of people have talked about attitudes. You know, in the Al-Anon, I believe it's at the start of it, it says changed attitudes can aid recovery. And this is really, really true. You just have to change your point of view on how you work this program or what's going on in your life. And anything is possible after that. If you change your attitude and pray to God, I think anything is possible. I don't know what I was going to tell you about the attitudes before that, but I've gone completely blank. And I told Ortha I may talk for 15 minutes or 78 or whatever it was that he told me that was on the tape. But we've had nothing but good things happen in our life. I was going to tell you about the tools that Al-Anon has given me. And one of the little known tools, the tools are like calling people, showing up at meetings, you know, having a sponsor, having numerous friends, and both in AA and in Al-Anon. I've got another one for you that you may not know about, but we all wear a little tool belt, you know, for Al-Anon. And I have found that one of the best things in my tool belt is invisible duct tape. And many times I have to whip it out and put it over my mouth in order to retain my serenity. And I told you my serenity started, or maybe I didn't, I don't know. The start of my serenity was September the 28th, 1972. Now, serenity comes and goes depending on your state of mind and where you are with God. Another thing that they have taught me in Al-Anon is, hey, if you forgot to pray this morning, you better stop right now and start your day all over with a prayer. And you can start, if you're having a bad day, just start it over again. There's no reason then why you can't do that. And what it's given me is, it's been a long time since I have gone anywhere that I did not know one person, at least in a meeting or at a conference or whatever. And for me, that is so reassuring, and it makes me feel safe and wonderful, because Al-Anon and AA is a safe place. And I know that hope lives in Al-Anon, and I'm sure hope lives in AA. And I thank you guys so much for letting me come and just talk. I'm not a speaker, but thank you so much.